Love is very often mistaken only as a personal quality of God possessing a partial significance. Love related to the absolute truth is in its content perfectly impersonal. Truth is like a diamond with many facets. As such, from this great reality are born all the forces that work in nature. Vishnu, who is held by his devotees as the highest truth, as the embodiment of love, has in him coexisting the dual force of protection and destruction. While he is all-loving protector of his devotees, he is at the same time the ruthless destroyer of all those who are the enemies of his devotees. Love is a double-faced truth in which both the creative and destructive elements are combined. If we give deep thought to understand the psychology of love, we cannot but arrive at the conclusion that it is the very nature of love to build up a wall of protection on the one hand and to simultaneously break down and demolish objects and things on the other for providing materials out of which alone the wall could be constructed. So it must be conceded that creation and destruction are concomitant and indivisible aspects of the same primal force. Creation means destruction, and destruction is synonymous with creation. In other words, nothing can be created without destruction, and nothing can be destroyed without a new creation. Then the question arises, is there no existence in which there is harmony, equality, and peace? Certainly there is such an existence which is beyond the forces manifest in nature. God, who is infinite love, is at once the static truth and dynamic spirit. In the static existence of God there is equality and harmony, whilst on the plane of physical nature there is eternal clash of forces, starting from the central power active in the manifestation. The world, as we now see it, can be broadly divided into two camps, one striving to bring about universal peace and friendship, and the other preparing for a tremendous struggle for destruction on a vast scale. Universal love, in the view of those who advocate it, refers, in fact, only to such of the people who subscribe to the cult of friendship and peace. Harsh and very often intolerant criticism and condemnation are hurled at the opponents of peace by the votaries of universal love. Here, love, which presumes to be only nonviolent and forgiving in nature, is not behindhand in raising a revolt against those who seek to create disorder in the life of humanity. The people who advocate peace would surely not have friendly communion and intercourse with the protagonists of war. Though not on the physical plane, a still mental warfare is actually going on between these two opponents. The ferocious animal, tiger, in brutally destroying the life of other animals, is at the same time friendly and loving towards its young one and its own kind. This may be equally true of the peoples in the opposing camps. Many spiritually minded souls, while studying the great scripture of Gita, read into it a meaning in agreement with their own limited and one-sided ideal. They contend the Gita is purely a philosophical work relating to the fight going on in the human breast between the sattvic and tamasic forces that work in it. The Gita is not merely philosophical, but is eminently an historical work. The Lord is definitely declared to protect the weak, helpless, and pious people of the earth, and to destroy the demonical and wicked people, I am born from age to age. It is evident in one act of the Lord, he is at once the lover and protector of those who take refuge in him, and the grim destroyer of those who stand in opposition to him and his people. Still, we look upon Sri Krishna as the very incarnation of love. Love is not a dreamy ideal in which nonviolence and non-existence alone exist, as some would argue. But it is a comprehensive truth from which issue a power that at once upholds unity and friendliness and tramples to the dust all causes of discord and righteousness. Even in the history of later sages in the world, this strange and mysterious working of the Lord of Love is clearly apparent. We have in the Punjab Guru Gobind Singh, his intrepid soldier saint who led an army for safeguarding the Sikh shrines from the devastating touch of Mohammedans. Then again we have in Maharashtra Samath Ramdas and Shivaji, who also under similar conditions waged a religious war against the enemies of their faith. Whether by thought, word, or action, we have to admit there is a ceaseless war going on in the heart of humanity. Now what is needed on the part of a real spiritual hero is to stand up on behalf of righteousness, that is, of those who are struggling to reach the inner harmony and peace of the immortal spirit, and adjust the external life accordingly, and then fight with all the opposing influence from whatever direction they come with a brave and unflinching heart, either by thought, word, or action. We are afraid of physical action, while we are not so when we try to put down the opposing force by thought or word. This distinction is invidious and not in keeping with the realization of the highest truth. Love is not a weak, halting, and cowardly thing. It is ever bold, forward, and heroic. No good can come by shilly-shallying with the sense of this sublime word. We admit God is love, but we are at our wits' end as to how to explain or account for the work of destruction that is going on a gigantic scale in the universe about us, emanated as it is from such a God who is the sole controller of all the forces that mold and remold the destinies of the world. The truth is, God is pure, impersonal love, and those who take refuge in him are saved, and those who are against him perish. When we are preaching universal love with the object of awakening mankind to the realization of its indwelling cosmic spirit, which is one, we must not forget we are at the same time invoking in nature a mighty and all-devouring power that would spell ruin and disaster to humanity. To set up this malevolent force and then sit quiet, taking refuge in the cult of nonviolence and non-resistance, is sheer imprudence and cowardice. The eternal fight between the self and non-self, between the altruistic and selfish impulses in mankind, has an inevitable place in the play of nature. Ours is to side with the former and wage war on the latter, until the last breath leaves our body, as much on the physical plane as on the mental. If we dare to face truth, let us do so preparing ourselves for any fate. Man is a fighter by nature's own gift. Let us then fight, having God who is love as our goal. Transcending all the weakening influences of the gunas or modes of prakriti, let us start a world crusade against tyranny, arrogance, pride, and oppression, wherever it is found. The earth is groaning beneath the heavy and heartless tread of dictators drunk with brute power and authority. A tame philosophy of flowery words and smooth phrases is not the demand of the time spirit. Its message is a call for concerted action, charged with firmness and determination. I've chosen for my subject this morning the Divine Teacher. And I think the 23rd Psalm depicts that in a most wonderful way. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. If we will take God as our shepherd in every single instance that comes before us, in every incident which happens in our lives, then indeed he will lead us through the door into the divine that is to be found only within ourselves. You know, as I was meditating this morning more and more, I'm being drawn inside. And I feel the tremendous power of God within me. It seems to be, to some degree, changing from the mother aspect to the father aspect. It is more stern, it is more powerful, it is more determined that things must be done, and they must be done now, to change those who come before me and to help them to realize the divinity within themselves. When I talk of Christ, I speak of the universal Christ, that one who called himself the light of the world, the door, the sheepfold, many other names. I am that I am. And he is that one that first came out from God as pure spirit, the only begotten Son of God. Now, all of Orthodox Christianity thinks of Jesus, the man, as being the only Son of God. And this is ridiculous when we think that also in Colossians it says that he is the firstborn of every creature. And so if we think of him as that first movement of God, that first spark of spirit emanating from himself as he moved and wanted to express himself, then we think of Jesus the Christ in a totally different way. Because it is said in the Christian scriptures that Jesus was the Son of Man. He was that spark of spirit which came to teach mankind, to guide him, to enlighten him through all of his humanness. So he is the good shepherd in that case. But also, we must remember that he became the sheep that was sacrificed. He knew that he had to go, because he said, Father, if it be thy will, take this cup from my lips. But it was but for this hour that I came. He knew that until he sacrificed himself as the Son of Man, who had come to save the world from the sin of separation from God, that he could never become the Christed One, that one who had attained full enlightenment. He fought with the Pharisees. He fought with them over every miracle that he did, and they fought with him. When he healed the sick and the blind, they said that he was not the Son of God, that he was a charlatan. But still, those who had been healed testified. And let me remind you that when it speaks of healing, it doesn't speak only of healing the body, of a human blindness of the eye, but it speaks of healing the blindness, the ignorance, the darkness that has ascended and permeated and encompasses the soul. The divine teacher comes to lift man out of his humanness, to perfect that humanness to the point where he is ready to surrender himself and everything that he has at the feet of God. And then this psalm comes into being. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. When you come to that moment of total, of final surrender, then the Lord becomes your shepherd. And he is at that time Jesus, still the Savior, the Son of Man. He said, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. Now what does that mean? It means that the pastures represent the spiritual consciousness of the devotee. He leadeth me beside the still waters. And that refers to the Sushumna passage, or the spine, which is empty, but which can be filled with spirit. The Kundalini, or the serpent force, as it is referred to in the Christian scriptures, is coiled at the base of the spine. And gradually, as the devotee becomes more and more enamored with his desire to be one with God, this serpent force uncoils itself and goes up this empty passage where the still waters are. He restoreth my soul. Indeed, he does. He puts us through whatever experiences are necessary. He makes us face the things that we have done in the past, not only in this lifetime, but since our coming out from him and going away from him in consciousness. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Because anyone who says that they want God realization and still does not conform to the Ten Commandments and the do's and the don'ts of every great religion in the world is giving pure lip service. You cannot serve God and mammon too at one at the same time and hope to come out with God realization. You must give yourself to God totally. It is a total sacrifice. And Jesus, the man, showed us the way to do this. And because he was that first one from God. He was pure spirit, and he took on a form of flesh. But he is that divine within every single living thing in this world. Therefore, if we look at him from the universal standpoint, we must acknowledge that he is greater than Buddha, than Zoroaster, than Mohammed, than Nanak, than all of the great teachers who have led humanity out of the darkness into the light, because he was the original one who came forth. I'm not speaking of Jesus the man as the Orthodox Christians speak of him, but of that Christ spirit, that Christ consciousness, that Christ power, that which is the life, the breath, the everything in every man, and without which man cannot live, nor move, nor breathe, nor have his being. It is amazing how many excuses I find from people all the time. Well, I would like to come to church on Wednesday evenings. I would like to come to church on Sundays, but I have to do this, I have to do that, I have to do something else. And they disregard totally the fact that if it were not for this God whom they refuse to come and worship and put first, that they would not be able to do one little tiny thing of all of the other things that they do in place of worshiping him. It is high time that we awaken to our responsibility in the spirit. Man is so apt to try to assume his responsibility in the world, and he does this because of his need to supply his wants. And everything has become money, money, money. Money is our God, because money can buy the things which keep us alive. It is necessary under our present system, certainly. But we should not make of it a God, because it is a false God. And I have talked to you time and time again that if you give your all to God, he will take care of you. I remember so well when my husband and I went to the ashram to be under Swami Ramdas's guidance in the beginning, when I said to him, Papa, when we get our God realization and we are so constantly filled with bliss that we are inebriated to the point that we can't look after ourselves, who will take care of us? And he said, oh, God must surely always take care of such ones. And so he has. But you see, it isn't just that way all the time. You are always one with God when you have paid the full price. But when you come down into this world of duality to teach his truth, which you yourself have experienced through going, picking up your cross, which is your body, and following the way of the Christ, which was to annihilate the human within himself, that is the everyday human, and find his oneness with God, his Christhood, it is a very different thing, because you have to descend to the level of those you teach. And therefore you are involved in a war that is unbelievable, because you are fighting all of the forces, and you have to go above the fight. You have to go to God alone, as each and every one of us should do, and place the whole responsibility in his hands. But that is not difficult when you relax and just realize who and what you are in God. But there are times when it stacks up, when you don't have time to rest and relax. And there are times, and lately has been among those times, when things have been coming at God in this form so fast, so rapidly, and so tremendously, in so many ways that are adverse as well as wonderful, that sometimes God in this form feels like giving out with the primordial scream. You've heard about it in classes that they are given in order to help people to unleash their problems, many of them deep-seated, many of them stemming from former incarnations, and they goad them to the point where they go all to pieces. I am not in favor of these things. I think it should be approached in a different way. But every now and then, things get pretty tough. And to let your emotions out, to cry, or to say, you have hurt me, is good. It is very good. Because there has to be a very good reason for your feeling that way. And you see, God is imprisoned in this human body in the beginning through his own karma. And then after he has realized who and what he is, through his own desire to help himself and the rest of humanity. And it is not an easy task, I can assure you, especially when people don't do what is asked of them and you don't get the results, but you only get trouble after trouble, vice after vice set before you, and those that come before you professing they want God realization, doing all of the wrong things so that they will never get it. Do they not realize who it is that they are punishing, who it is that they are stealing from, are keeping from? It is themselves. They are keeping themselves from realizing the truth, the bliss, the peace, the wonder of God. And any time such a God-realized soul wants to, they can withdraw from the world and go inside and go up into the mountaintop, even as the Christ did, because that is the upper consciousness, and forget the world of duality. But God has kept himself so busy in this form that he doesn't even have time to do it. And it is day and night the telephone rings, sometimes several times from one person, someone who is in trouble. And you have to let God take care of it, because in our human sense, what do we know? You know, instead of always giving the answer to someone else when they come to you or you see something wrong with them, realize that there has to be a good reason for what they're doing, for how they're acting, what they're feeling. And so instead of saying, well, do this and you will be out of it, say, well, why do you suppose you are doing this? What makes you feel this way? What makes you feel this way? Let's get down to the reason. And they'll cover up most every time because they don't want to be honest, not only with you, but with themselves. They want to keep all of this hidden in there. And it stays hidden, and it grows and grows and grows like a festering boil until finally, if there isn't a good clean cut incision, it breaks open and it flies all over and it's a mess and it leaves a deep scar. But we have to approach these things in the beginning gently, as I've said many times before. I always approach everyone with all of the love of God within my being, and I keep on doing that and doing that and doing that, until sometimes the point comes where they leave me no choice but to use the love of the crucible. And then I have to move in. That's the father aspect. He gets out the little razor strap. I've had it on me too a few times in my life, so I know what it's all about. Believe me. But these things are all a part of the job which the divine teacher has to go through, to do, to teach. And he comes in each one of us. And in all of the things, the experiences that he puts us through, he is teaching us a lesson. He is teaching us that this world of duality is not to be depended upon. That there is no single person that you can depend upon absolutely in total faith and trust. That it is only when you have gone above the human that you are trustworthy, only then. And he comes to show you that there is a narrow, straight gate that you have to go through. And Jesus spoke of this gate. And this is the way of the spine. And he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody can go to the Father except through me. And he's speaking of the sixth center up here, the center of Christ consciousness. Nobody can go to the Father except that this serpent force goes up through there, this world of duality, and merges, becomes one with the one who resides on the throne of your consciousness and the altar of your heart. There is no other way. There is no other way at all. He is a supreme teacher. It's a supreme teacher. And he is your real self. When you are ready to give up this little self and all of its attachment to the senses, and reach out for God alone, you will find that your whole being will change, that you will be lifted up, that the power that enters you will be so great that you, like I, have to close your eyes in order to contain it, because it is so great that you feel that sometimes as if you were to open your eyes, your whole being would fall apart, all the atoms would go into a million different pieces and places. So this is the way it is. It's a reward that you get. But we can't think of just sitting in peace and in bliss. We have to do God's work. We have to do his work. And he speaks of this death state. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. As we start this journey of the soul, which St. John described as the dark night of the soul, God is with us. It is the Savior, the man Jesus, the spiritual part of our humanness that is with us going through every bit of it. And yet it is he himself who is going through this experience because he knows he has to die as the Son of Man in order to express himself as the Son of God. And he said, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. In other words, his light and his power, his consciousness will direct you. You have this feeling inside. And you're in a terrible state of war because you're between the two thieves on your cross, the force, the thief of evil and the thief of good. The good one wants to go with the Son of Man to paradise when he goes. But the bad thief, that one that's attached to the senses, doesn't want to go. And he uses every trick in the book. Every trick in the book. In spite of what I said last Sunday, there are still those people who are asking, is it wrong? Is it wrong to live together without benefit of marriage? That is called fornication in the first chapter of Romans. One of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not commit adultery. That is to be with somebody else's husband or wife. And somebody still says, is it wrong? It is wrong. Because you are expelling your life force, that force which should be retained in your body and taken as the means of giving you your God realization. Now, I'm not speaking of the sexual act because it says the marriage bed is undefiled. And sex is a part of life. It keeps humanity coming and going all of the time. But I'm speaking of the desecration of your bodies. You leave no sanctity, nothing to reach out for in its purity when you indulge with this one, with that one, and indulge in the act anytime you feel like it. It is a tremendous experience between a husband and wife who are totally in love with God and with each other. There is no greater experience except the experience of God realization itself, which then makes the sex act seem like nothing by comparison. And you cry when you have lost the greater treasure and accepted the lesser one. I'm not speaking against sex in that. I am speaking about obeying the laws of God. I'm speaking of putting your mind upon Him alone. It is not right. Why do you think the spiritual teacher comes to teach you the difference between right and wrong, to help you to overcome your humanness in the ordinary sense so that you are the slave of the five senses and take you to the perfection of your humanness and the perfection of your divinity? Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies, and these enemies I have just described. Don't be misled. Because anybody who says that these things are not right, they are listening to the bad thief. They are not listening to the good one. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. And I have told you, as was put out in the Christian scriptures here, that when this moment comes and this serpent force, this kundalini force, as the Hindus call it, it's the same thing in every man, regardless of what his religious belief, starts to rise in the spine also, the fire starts to rise with it. And sometimes it just permeates your whole being. You feel like you're on fire. Your body becomes as red as a beet. And this is also shown in the Old Testament when it tells about Moses, who represents the law, and the burning bush, which is again your body. It is on fire with love for God. And so you have to have this oil rubbed in your on your body, and particularly in your scalp, because you do not want to burn out the electrolytes. And you must have plenty of liquid. Put an ice pack on your head. You're very fortunate that you have refrigeration and ice in this country so that this can be done. Because when I was in India, there was electricity in a homemade electrical plant from that was run only from 6 till 10 in the evening, and sometimes it went out in between there. There was no refrigeration. And so when I was going through this experience and my body was so much on fire, they felt that the cells in my brain would be damaged, and I do have some slight paralysis in my face cosmetically, but you do not notice it. But it is there as a result of the tremendous experience I went through with none of the things that you have for your use here. Because it does happen, believe me, it happens. And your head has to be kept cool. So that's why they wear the sacred ash. That you see these sadhus, these holy men with the sacred ash rubbed over their body and on their forehead, and we think these strange people. But they know a lot more about Christianity than we do in that sense, believe me. So the head has to be anointed with oil, rubbed in there, because it is a cooling agent, as is the sacred ash. And that is depicted right in here when it tells about Jesus being anointed with oil before he is going to go through this experience. This happens not only to one, but it has happened to several in this group. They know that I speak the truth. They know that. And when you finally come to the point where you have made the supreme sacrifice, where this kundalini or this serpent force has gone through this center of Christ consciousness, and we have indeed gone through Christ in order to find our oneness with God, then your cup runneth over, and the light which floods the brain, the light which furnishes the light by which these two eyes can see, then goes all through your body, and indeed your cup runneth over. Then, and then alone, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. This is the house of the Lord. This is the temple of the living God. And it is high time that we realized that we are God in human form. And we live up to that spiritual stature. That we raise ourselves up. And yet of ourselves we can do nothing. But one thing we can do. We can repeat his name. We can think of him night and day. We can surrender ourselves to him in full measure. And then he will come. Reminds me of a story that I read the other day in Ram Dass's book, Stories by Swami Ram Dass. And it told about a master trying to teach the truth to one of his devotees. And he was teaching deep truth, but the devotee's attention was not on the truth that the guru was teaching. Instead, there was a little hole right down near the floor where the guru was sitting, and there was a little mouse running in and out and running in and out. And the man, the devotee, was so busy looking at that little mouse running in and out that he hadn't really heard what the guru said. And the guru realized that the devotee hadn't been paying attention to him at all. And he said, would you tell me what I've just said to you? He said, yes. He said, only the tail is out. Only the tail is out. And that's the way it is. Only the tail is out. Let us get busy. Let us realize that we are God in human form. Let us find that Christ consciousness within ourselves. You see, Christianity holds forth the whole story, with the exception that it doesn't tell that it takes as long to ascend into the heaven of your own being as it does into the hell of your own being when you go through this so-called crucifixion or transformation. Because just as it takes 3 days to descend into the hell of Hades or the place of darkness and face that which you have been, that which you are now. So also it takes 3 days or three separate times to ascend into the kingdom of heaven within yourself, because we are speaking of the consciousness in the seven spinal centers. The heart center is the place where the battle of Armageddon or the battle of Kurukshetra, as the Hindus call it, is fought. And you must ascend and go through this Christ center. You must let the shepherd lead you. You become the sacrificial lamb in trying to take all of your subjects which are within yourself through that narrow gate, that narrow door into yourself, into the real self, the I am that I am. And when you can stand and say with absolute truth and impunity, I am that I am, and know it with everything within you that you are God in human form. You will look back on the life that you have led in the human state, and you will think, my God, how could I have been so stupid, so blind, so dumb, so ready to punish myself? I tell you the truth. When I was in Los Angeles recently, I had the privilege of having, well, I didn't eat, but I was invited to dinner with three Catholic priests. And I was on a diet, so I had only tea. But we had a most interesting conversation. And one priest was one that I would call a meat and potatoes man. He was quite heavy. He loved to eat. He was jolly. And he had to leave and give the next mass. So he left first. And afterward, I got in for the latter part of his sermon. He said to me, where were you? I looked for you and I couldn't find you. I said, oh, I was there. He said, was it all right? And I said, yes, Father, I enjoyed it very much. The younger priest kept asking me questions. He was wonderful. He gave me some great opportunities. And I just loved it. And God was full of power that day and all the charm in the world, I tell you. Perfectly at ease. Because I had the truth. And then there was the priest who was in charge of the rest of them and of the whole diocese, or the whole church there. And he was a wonderful, wonderful man. He was very quiet, but he was listening very intently to what I said. And the younger priest was called away in about two-thirds of the conversation. And we kept talking. But he was struggling, obviously, with his desire to stay and talk, because I had something different to say to him, and his remembrance of the fact that he was a priest of the Catholic order. And I didn't pull my punches at all. I told him of my meeting with Mother Teresa. I told him that she had told me that I was a Roman Catholic previously, which was true, and she said that I should again take communion. And I said, no, Mother, I don't feel directed to do that. And she said, oh, you must. I could not live without taking the body and blood of my Lord every morning. And I said to her, Mother, 20 years ago in an ashram in South India, I went through the mystical crucifixion. And I said, years later, when I finished that, I said, I had the Holy Eucharist from my own body in my own hand, and I took that. I said, having had the reality, how in the world can I go back and take bread and wine in the form after having experienced him within myself? And he looked at me and he said nothing. Then I told him the story about my having raised the saint from the dead. And I think he thought perhaps I was slightly mad. And I said to him, but Father, I said, isn't it a very interesting thing that Jesus said, all of these works that I do, ye may do also, and even greater works than these that I do, ye may do, and yet nobody believes him? What could he say? It's the truth. It is the truth. I didn't do it, but God in this form did it, and I knew nothing about how to do it. I had to go according to his guidance, his direction. And David Ranney, who was here last Sunday, witnessed this when this same little saint sat there and told me that he hadn't realized what I had done for him until 3 months after I had left to return to America, when all of his devotees had presented him with a documentary of the whole situation, how he was in a state of rigor mortis, absolutely cold, and how they had called me and I had come, and today he was alive. And he said, will you tell me about it, Mother, in his childlike voice? So I told him, and with the exception of something that happened after I had left, which I couldn't know the truth of, every single word of it he verified as that which had been written down for him that I had done. And there were hundreds of witnesses. That made history in Calcutta. Yet I did nothing. I did nothing. Wake up to the power of God within you. Do you not know that each and every one of you have this same God in you who can perform these same works, these same miracles? Of course you do. But you have to work at it. You can't give in and serve mammon and then hope to be able to find God within yourself. You are cheating yourself. You are cheating yourselves. And when you come to that moment, when you love only him, when you're willing to give yourself in absolute totality and surrender to his at his feet, then he will come to you. He will lift you up. He will put you through any experiences which are necessary, but he will also protect you and guide you. because the Lord is your shepherd, and you shall not want. And he will lead you through the green pastures and beside the still waters. And he will lead you to that place where the banquet of God, the banquet of Spirit, is set out before you. And then you will know that you were, you always have been, you are, and you always will be one with him. Because how can it be otherwise when there is nothing but God everywhere? God who created this world and everything in it. And nothing was created except by him. Nothing. So there is God everywhere. Let us all put our shoulders together and be a solid army in God. Find our own God realization and then spread this light throughout the world. My God, how badly it is needed at this moment. And we're not going to do it if we just give in to the pleasures of the senses and go our own way. Let us spend the time in meditation and communion with him. Let us spend the time in service to God in all of those that we meet. Let us become a candle lit on a hilltop so that all who look at us may see his light shining there. Let us give ourselves to him in full measure, and he will give himself to us in full measure. And you will find love, you will find peace, you will find supply, you will find satisfaction, you will find bliss, everything that you need in such great measure that you will not be able to contain it. This is my hope, this is my wish for you, and this is what I strive to give you every moment of my life. Will you not open your minds, your hearts, your hands, and accept it, and take it and do something with it? I can't do it by myself. I'm only one. I am the one as you are, but I am only one separate cell of his body. And he needs a whole army, armies and armies and armies of people who are ready to go to him, to serve him, to love him with all of their hearts, their minds, their souls, and their strength. It is my deepest prayer that each and every one who is here will pick up his own cross, which is his body, and follow the Christ. Emulate him in every detail, even unto the death of the body for his name's sake. And you will find that you will awaken to a life that is so beautiful, so wonderful, so great, that everything else pales into insignificance beside it. Now let us pray to him. Oh, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet. And surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection. Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence. Are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss. Of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am he. O Heavenly Father. Open my eyes that I may see thy face. Open my ears that I may hear thy footsteps everywhere. Open my heart that I may feel the glory of thy love. O Heavenly Father. May thy love shine forever. Upon the sanctuary of my devotion. May I be able to awaken all hearts with my own. And bring them to thee.